I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places. Truth is never.
And welcome to this Monday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host, John Quinlan. Coming up in the next hour, a discussion of poverty and focus on some of the solutions to this pervasive challenge, both locally and in the bigger picture. And we have two very special guests who will be joining us for the hour to discuss an issue that's been on the minds of many folks here close to home. Joining me in studio is Dean County Supervisor Heidi Wegleitner. Heidi is someone with a long history of involvement in this issue, including being an advocate for the homeless. She was one of the folks who were part of the catalyst for efforts to form a special commission, the Poverty Commission, organized through Dean County government, that will be addressing these issues. Heidi, welcome to A Public Affair.
Thanks for having me, John.
It's good to have you here today. And also on the phone is someone that Heidi was kind enough to introduce me to, someone who has also got a long and diverse history of involvement on this issues and other issues of economic justice. David Reamer joins us on the phone. He's a senior fellow at Community Advocates Public Policy Institute in Milwaukee. Just to highlight some of his recent accomplishments, he's been active for many years in reshaping Wisconsin and U.S. policies on welfare, poverty, health care, and education. He was chosen in 2010 to serve as a member of the Wisconsin Legislative Council's Special Committee on Health Care Reform Implementation. Among other works, he's the author of The Prisoners of Welfare, numerous other articles on poverty, health care reform, and public administration. Has worked as a fellow in public policy in London and Oxford going back to the early 2000s. Before that, having worked with the city of Milwaukee, and the decade before, going back to the 70s and the early 80s, where we worked in both government and the private sector, including being a legal advisor to Wisconsin Governor Patrick Lucey. David Reamer, welcome to A Public Affair.
It's a pleasure to join you, John, and Heidi as well. Good afternoon.
Well, thanks so much for being here today. Actually, Heidi, why don't we establish sort of the context for the collaboration that is taking part between you and other folks who are involved with creating the Dean County Poverty Commission, and David, I know you met at a recent conference, is that right?
Yeah, actually, it worked out really well. In May, I believe we had a press conference announcing the Poverty Commission, and at about the same time, the Coalition for Wisconsin Aging Groups had convened a roundtable discussion on why poverty matters. And David was there to present his work and the study that he's done to show how we really, if we wanted to, could drastically reduce poverty in this country in a short period of time. And so I was happy to participate in that roundtable discussion and talk a little bit about our local efforts here in Dane County to take some strategic approaches to addressing the root causes of poverty.
And we want to get right into, I think, some of the solutions that David has proposed. It's a very innovative program, and everything I've been reading about it says it really stands alone as one of those programs with a really high potential success rate. And you know, it's very exciting to be able to talk about in the realm of solutions, since we've been so bogged down here in the problem for so long. But before we do that, just briefly, you're describing kind of, you know, again, these different threads of conversation that have been happening around homelessness, recognition that we talk about a tale of two cities, or maybe in this case, a tale of two counties, where economic disparity really is a challenge that sometimes kind of goes invisible. Is part of the impetus for you wanting to get an actual poverty commission together to make it more visible, to make it something that's out there that we can deal with?
Absolutely. So the county board started on this work in 2008, and they actually created a task force to look at poverty and come up with some recommendations. And one of the recommendations was to establish a permanent commission on poverty. And, you know, the goal of that really is to engage the community and make sure that this is, you know, front and center in the policy work that Dane County does. So that's absolutely one of the really important pieces of this, because this touches on every different demographic. It's not just an urban problem, it's a rural problem. And, you know, no matter whether you're young or elderly, disabled, well-bodied. You know, poverty is impacting all sorts of people within the county and all sorts of departments within the county. So it's something that we all need to be aware of and work on together.
Do you think, given the recent economic downturn, some of the circumstances people are facing, people facing loss of their homes, for example, who thought that might never be a possibility, there's a little bit more of, but for the grace of God go I guess, you know, sentiment. And people are understanding this isn't just an abstract thing. This is something potentially affects us all, and we all need to be invested in.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you see more formerly middle-class people applying for public benefits, having to overcome, you know, certain conflicts with their own pride or ego to recognize that they need some help and support as well. And I've seen that in my daily work. I work as a legal services attorney with people in poverty every day. And it's we're all just, you know, many of us are one paycheck away, or reduced hours or job loss away from being homeless ourselves.
David Rimmer, I want to bring you into the conversation as well. As someone who's worked in this area, related areas like affordable health care, other things that you know, the economic bottom line is present in all of this. What motivates you for in terms of addressing poverty as one of the issues that we need to focus on?
Well, I think it's the biggest domestic challenge we face in the United States. We, for a country as successful and wealthy as ours, to have such a high percentage of our population still unemployed and poor is something that is not tolerable. It also, I think, contributes unnecessarily to a lot of costs and taxes that could be reduced. We have probably more crime, more lower property values, greater sense of kind of anxiety about ourselves as a society, because there still are so many poor people. It also, frankly, undermines our ability to go and be as influential an actor on the world stage as we might be. It's embarrassing for us to go forward and talk about the virtues of our society when we've got, depending on how you count it, 10, 15, 20% of the people here below our own nation's poverty line. So there are a lot of different reasons for wanting to solve this. And I guess part of what struck me over the years is that it's really not that complicated a problem. We've been debating it for years and coming up with different solutions for years. But at the end of the day, and I think this is what our recent study showed, poverty really comes down to three things. There's a group of people who are able to work, want to work, but can't find work because there aren't enough jobs very often, certainly at this time in our economic cycle. So part of the problem is there's a shortage of jobs for unemployed people. Secondly, a fair number of people work in jobs that just don't pay enough. The minimum wage is about $7.25 an hour, I think, in both the United States and Wisconsin. It's hard if you earn that much to get by. Even if you earn somewhat more than that, it's hard. So first problem, there aren't enough jobs. Second problem is a lot of jobs just don't pay enough to get above the poverty line. And then a third problem is that we have people who are our parents, our grandparents, have retired on Social Security after decades of working, but the money that they get, the payment they get from Social Security or that they get from disability program for those that can't participate in the labor market is sometimes just not enough to get them above the poverty line. So we basically tested a simple model that offered so-called transitional jobs to the unemployed and underemployed, proposed raising the minimum wage and restructuring the EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit, so that if you did work full-time, you got a higher income, and proposed providing a tax credit for those seniors and people on disability who just don't earn enough. And it turns out that when you do that, you can cut poverty, according to the Urban Institute, which did an independent analysis, by well over 50%. It's not that complicated a problem. It's one that can be solved fairly easily through policies that are, I think, somewhat popular with the American public and not that hard to administer.
I mean, it sounds like it's a fine tuning of existing programs. It also sounds like that maybe the cost benefit analysis is pretty clear too. That if you're able to reach out to folks who are in poverty and help bring them out of poverty, that there are economic benefits for everyone.
Well, I think that's right. The proposals that we tested were not wild, radical new ideas. Every one of them is one that we've done at one point in our nation's history and are doing on a small scale today. So, for example, back in the Depression, we had a large-scale transitional jobs program. It was the one that most people remember was the WPA, the Works Progress Administration. There was also a smaller program called the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, that put lots of people to work. Although people didn't stay in those jobs very long, they didn't want to be in those jobs. They wanted regular jobs, so they moved out of them when they could. Today, in Wisconsin and in several other states, we have a small-scale program, but that has bipartisan support, called the Transitional Jobs Program. It offers wage-paying jobs to unemployed people, and most of them don't stay in those jobs very long. They more typically, once they've shown that they're good workers and that employers would want to hire them, they're very often hired on a permanent basis at higher wages. So that's one thing we've been doing in the past or doing currently that we just need to do more of. Another important policy change is just to raise the minimum wage. It probably ought to be closer to $8.50 or $9 an hour. That would not have very significant negative effects, but it would help low-income workers. Perhaps more important than that is changing our earned income tax credit. We've had an earned income tax credit at the national level since about 1974-75. It's had support from every single president, from Gerald Ford to Barack Obama, including Ronald Reagan, both Bushes. Ronald Reagan was one of its biggest supporters. He said it was one of the best, most pro-family, anti-welfare, pro-work programs to ever come out of Congress. So what we need to do is just rearrange it a little bit so that it provides a bigger earnings supplement for people who don't have children, and then a somewhat bigger one for people who do have children. And we also should do it in ways that reduce one of the unintended effects of the current design, which is a little bit of a marriage penalty. And then, but again, we're not talking about a new policy. We're really talking about taking something that we've had at the federal level. There's a state earned income tax credit that was supported by Democrats and Republicans. Tommy Thompson was a big supporter, just rejiggering it a bit. And then the final policy is just to make sure that programs that we intended to get people a decent income, if they're seniors or have a disability, namely Social Security or SSI, actually get people to the poverty line. So again, we're not talking about a new program. We're talking about some revisions in the formula. If we did those four things and didn't do anything else, we could cut poverty, according to this Urban Institute analysis, between 58 and 81%
wow.
In Wisconsin. Just a big, big drop.
Yeah, it sounds like just amazing results for, again, what you're describing, building on existing programs that people believe in. Just for those of you who are joining us midstream, just want to reset the show. Again, this is a public affair. I'm your host, John Quinlan, and my guests are Dean County Supervisor Heidi Wegleitner, who joins us in studio. She is one of the new members of the Dean County Poverty Commission and a longtime advocate on behalf of economic justice. Also joining us on the phone is David Reamer. He's a senior fellow, the Community Advocates Public Policy Institute over in Milwaukee, one of many hats he wears. And what we were talking about just now is something we hope to explore in greater depth throughout the hour. It's a four-part policy agenda, a policy package developed through the Urban Institute that addresses very directly some of the causes of poverty and applies quite well to the specific situation here in Wisconsin and Dane County. I guess I want to get back to some of the four specific solutions that David's mentioned in just a moment. But before we do that, I think it's worth exploring why this has been such a difficult issue to address. Why it's so challenging, even though perhaps relative to a lot of the things that we invest in, in terms of government and business, why this hasn't always been something that we we jump at the opportunity to be able to get. I guess is some of that, Heidi, just kind of a basic stigma and aversion to talking about class or economic difference, or where do you think that lies? That's a tough one.
You don't know what I really think? No. I think that's part of it. I mean, I think it's hard for people sometimes, you know, politicians maybe to identify with people who are not attending their fundraisers or, you know, have fallen on harder times. I mean, I don't know, that maybe that's kind of cynical, but there is a reluctance, I think, to talk about class and to recognize that we do in Madison have two Madisons and starting to get more coverage. But, you know, there's even a stigma when you're talking about, you know, middle class folks talking about homeless folks and that, you know, and affordable housing moving into a neighborhood or something like that. So I think there is sort of a division that exists. And I think there's, you know, residential segregation that is a factor in that. Some isolation we have from our fellow community members who may be struggling, and that invisibility that you were talking about before. So, and I think there is a problem of not understanding how simple it is, as David had talked about, and people thinking, well, this isn't something that we can do, or maybe it's, this is something that the feds really need to do, but we really can't do anything about it locally. You know, they're sort of like it's someone else's job to start working on this and improving the situation. And I think that happens in a lot of things, but certainly it's happened in with regard to addressing poverty.
David Rimmer, I know this is a complicated, multifaceted question, but you know, as you were talking about that earlier history of the 1930s the efforts to create different jobs, the role of government in helping people to do these things. Another historic development, flash forward to, is in the 60s, the Civil Rights Movement, and Dr. King. Having not just a message of racial justice, but also economic justice. And some folks kind of taken aback by that. How are those two things connected? And you're distracting from the focus where it should be and other things. It seems like sometimes these issues of economic justice get sidelined because of bigger debates about the role of government, or are we treading into socialism, or all kinds of other things. But anyway, what are your thoughts? Why do we get so distracted sometimes and don't focus in on something that should be so essential?
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned Dr. King. As you know, and many listeners know, we're only about a month away from the 50th anniversary of the historic March on Washington. My father, Neil Reamer, who taught political science at UW-Milwaukee, went on that march, and he brought back to me the official button of the March on Washington. You can often see it on Dr. King's lapel when they have photographs of him giving the I have a dream speech. If you actually look at what that button says, it has the official title of the March on Washington. It was called the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. The organizers wanted to emphasize jobs as much as freedom. They actually gave it prominence in the slogan. And many people will also remember that when Dr. King died, it was in Memphis. He was marching for better wages and working conditions for sanitation workers, garbage collectors in Memphis. So he was fighting as much, and when he died, he was to his last breath talking about economic justice, employment, as much as he was about civil rights. They go hand in hand. They're inseparable. But I think the reason why we often don't talk about the need for more jobs, the need for ensuring that work pays more than the poverty line, is that there is a tendency to often blame the poor themselves for their predicament.
Yeah,
a lot of poor people certainly do a lot of things that are that are counterproductive. I mean, there's no question that a lot of low income people, like a lot of middle and high income people, do things they shouldn't do. They sometimes drop out of school, sometimes get involved in drugs, sometimes have children before they're able to support them as teenagers or even later. They often don't concentrate enough on their studies. these are problems that a lot of poor people experience. A lot of middle-class people engage in the same counterproductive behaviors. But it's not really those behaviors that fully explain poverty. They explain why it is that people who make those bad decisions are more likely to be poor. But poverty itself is simply the result of the labor market not offering enough work and not offering enough work that pays. And the reason we know that is from our own experience from the last few years. If you went back just to the late 90s, we had an economy where people were doing very well, where there was a job at that point almost for everybody, wages were rising, poverty was falling. Then a decade later, 2008, 2009, we had the crash, a massive increase in unemployment, a big increase in poverty. Well, the people were the same. The American population, the adult population in 1999 was essentially the same population as 2009. They were equally flawed in the decisions they had made and equally virtuous. They were equally indifferent to work or committed to work. There was no change in the people. And yet we went from almost 1 or 2% unemployment to 9 or 10% unemployment, from a lower level of poverty to a higher level of poverty. So ultimately, the bad choices that people make or the bad experiences that they suffer, racial discrimination and other factors, they explain which people end up being poor in this kind of game of musical chairs that all of us are caught up in. But they don't explain poverty. The reason why we have poverty is, to use the musical chairs analogy, we're playing a game where there are more players than there are chairs, and where about a third of the chairs are lousy chairs.
Yeah.
And we can improve the competitive ability of the players all we want, and we can reduce the barriers that they face all we want. But if we have 100 people competing for 80 chairs, 20 people aren't going to get a chair. And if of those 80 chairs, 30 or 40 of them are lousy chairs that tend to fall down, then changing the ability of the competitors to compete may influence who gets a chair and who gets a good chair. But you're always going to have 20 people without a chair, without a job, and you're going to always have a lot of people in jobs that don't pay enough to have a decent income.
I want to come back in just a moment to I guess the theme of again, that somehow folks who are poor need to be blamed, need to be guilted into a better circumstance. And this is bringing to mind an interview several years ago, I think one of the most powerful interviews I did with Barbara Ehrenreich, who'd written a book called Five and Dime, who'd really put herself in the shoes of someone on minimum wage and described so eloquently, I think, the flip side of that, just amazing adaptability, flexibility, wisdom you have to have sometimes to get by on a low income. And anyway, there are many interesting aspects off of this. Before that, we do have some folks who've invited to come in on our invitation to join us on line. Caller, your comment or question, please.
Yeah, hello. I guess my concern is this. I think you addressed it partially already, so you stole my thunder in a way. But the issue is class. It's not race and it's not gender, but people are still not thinking in those terms. And that is where the problem lies. I go to meetings and people are still thinking in terms of color, that if you're, economically disadvantaged or having problems with the school system, the problem needs to be addressed along racial lines, but that's not true. And I think that we have to be aware of that, and that's something still a lot of people aren't ready to grasp. And I also like very much your analogy about chairs, and I think you're right. What is going to happen is we're going to have, maybe 1,000 people fighting for 97 chairs. Those are the chairs that collapse and won't stand up. And we'll also have maybe 3 chairs that are made out of teak wood, and those will be permanently occupied by certain people, and they will always be occupying those chairs. You don't hear about evictions in Maple Bluff at all. The people who are there permanently, and they know it, and that's part of the problem right there. I would also like to make another point, too, that for every attorney we have like Heidi, There's 1,000 other attorneys whose interests are dedicated to protecting the corporations and the investment bankers and the landlords. And that's the other part of the problem right there, is that the access to the legal system is restricted in that fashion. And there aren't enough attorneys like Heidi around. And I'll take my answers off the air. Thanks for a crucial call on a serious topic.
All right. Thanks for your question. Heidi, did you have something off of that?
Well, I think it's important to realize that, you know, the issues of class, race, and gender, I mean, there's a lot of intersectionality there between different sources of oppression. So while I agree that poverty really is a statement and relevant to discussion of class and not having enough jobs, not having enough good chairs, as David rightly analogized, I do think that when I'm thinking about the people that I serve as a poverty lawyer, disproportionately people of color, disproportionately women with children, you know, single mothers. So I think you need to understand how these things work together and the institutional ways in which this is perpetuated and disproportionately in ways that impact different groups of people a little differently. And certainly I agree with the caller's point about access to justice. Obviously, we do not have equal access to justice in this country, and that is a big problem.
You know, I think as we discuss this issue in the context of the Madison schools or the achievement gap, other decisions, sometimes it's very easy for us to get into camps of it is either race or class. But it strikes me that very often it's the intersectionality that's relevant, that either or both can be relevant. David Reamer, your thoughts?
Well, I agree with what much of what the caller said, and with Heidi's response. I want to give credit, by the way, for the sort of application of the musical chairs analogy to this situation to a UW-Madison graduate student, now a professor at Washington University in St. Louis, named Mark Rank. He's the one that first began using this, or at least the first person I picked it up from, and so I want to give him credit. And I like the metaphor because it helps address both the reality of class and discrimination based on race and gender and other factors. It takes it into account, and yet at the same time helps us recognize that the biggest, the fundamental problem is the shortage of chairs and the quality of some of the chairs. If you were to have a bunch of kids play this game of musical chairs, and you were to, you know, say, all right, all the girls have to compete walking around on their knees, and all the black people have to compete holding one leg behind their back and hopping around on one leg, all of us would say how terribly unfair that is. We would want the competition to be fair, to be even, so that people win based on their ability. But ultimately, even though the game of musical chairs is a lot of fun, you know, when you do it in the backyard or the basement for a children's birthday party, it's not an experience that adults should be having with respect to the single most important relationship they have with society, which is the ability to have a job that lets them support themselves and their family. It's no fun to have an economic game where there are lots and lots of losers. It makes it even less fun when the losers tend to be people whose parents were poor, people who are of color, people who are women, people who have a disability, people who live in certain parts of the country. That makes it seem even cruelly unfair. But even if those forms of discrimination could be wiped out with the stroke of a pen, what good is an economic system in which we say to the great majority of adults, you're able to work, you want to work, you're expected to work, but we don't have enough jobs for you, and by the way, a very large number of you will get jobs that won't let you pay the rent, pay the electricity, or put food on the table. That is a cruel game, and we should end it for a whole bunch of the reasons that I talked about at the beginning. It would be one thing if ending that mismatch were complicated, if we couldn't do it, but we can. It isn't that complicated. It really is a matter of seeing this shortage of jobs and inadequacy of enough paying jobs, well-paying jobs, as the problem, and then implementing these policies It isn't that complicated. If in fact there's another approach that anyone on the show or anyone else can send in that shows how we could greatly reduce poverty at a lower cost, I'd be for that. But up until now, this is the only one that I've seen that has evidence would work.
All right. In just a moment, I think we'll go back and we'll punctuate those 4 points that you brought up just to make it a little clearer to our listeners, kind of both root causes and the solutions that are inherent in each of those 4 points. So, David, just to summarize briefly, the 4 points that you mentioned, transitional jobs for unemployed and underemployed adults, increase in minimum wage, an improved version of the earned income tax credit that supplements low-income people's earnings, then a tax credit for seniors and persons with disabilities. Let's start with the first one, transitional jobs for unemployed and underemployed adults. Is that something that's especially compelling now in the current economic downturn, also at a time when deindustrialization is occurring, other things that mean a lot of folks started in careers now that are no longer viable? They need to make a transition into something new.
I think it is, precisely for the reasons you mentioned. Back in the 50s or the 60s even, when we from time to time would have economic downturns, but there was a reasonable expectation that when the downturn was over, you could get your old job back, the need for transitional jobs was less strong. But now we've had high levels of unemployment for a long time. Many of the jobs that people were forced out of during this great recession are just gone. The industries are gone. The companies are gone. There's the only other options we have for helping these adults who want to work, who are capable of work, many of whom did work before, are we only have three things we can do. One is do nothing, which is what we're doing for a lot of them. The other is write them a check, which some of them qualify for through unemployment insurance, but that only lasts 26 weeks. And frankly, a lot of people getting that check don't want it. They don't want to be just getting a check and not working. They want to be doing something productive. The third thing is to offer folks work. This in the past was seen as more of a left-wing solution. But what's very exciting to me is that in Wisconsin and in other states, both Democrats and Republicans, both people on the left and the right, have come to see transitional jobs as an important solution to getting people work, getting people connected, ultimately to higher paid, unsubsidized work. In Wisconsin, some of the people that supported our program have included Democratic legislators like former Senator Spencer Coggs, former Representative Tamara Grigsby, but also Governor Walker and his Secretary of Children and Families, Eloise Anderson, have been big supporters. In around the country, out in California, you know, a state that the Democrats totally control, they have a transitional jobs program. So does Mississippi, whose governor was Haley Barbour, the former chairman of the Republican National Committee. So it's hit a sweet spot on the ideological spectrum, and I think that's a reason for pushing for it.
Well, that is quite a spectrum. We're going to get to the other 3 points that you mentioned in just a moment, but we do have a couple of callers on the line. I want to make sure that their voices are heard. Caller, your comment or question, please.
I hope I'm not too late with this because you seem to have gone on, moved on a little bit. But I wanted to, I agree with, the analogy of musical chairs makes sense. And I agree with the points that people have made about how things like race and gender intersect with class. But I think if you're going to look at solutions for this country, you have to really make a stronger point, particularly about the intersection with race and class. And all the statistics point that out. I mean, you have a 50% unemployment rate among black men. You have things like a disproportionate number of black people imprisoned, black men in particular suffering a much greater percentage of police brutality. So I think it's not just that we have to say these things intersect, but if you're going to look at solutions for this country, you have to realize that 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 intersection between race and class is very strong, and it's part of the, I don't know how to say this exactly, but part of the basis of what goes on in our country. And, you know, just to sum up, I've heard an expression, maybe other people have heard it too, that I've heard some black people use, which is, when white people discover the common cold, black people have already had pneumonia. Yeah. And I think that's true. That's all I have to say.
All right. Well, thank you, caller. I think very important points that you're bringing up. Off of our last caller's point, I guess I can't help but thinking of recent events, the Trayvon Martin decision and some of the things that have come up in that context, just in terms of an understanding that perhaps there are a lot of folks whose experience doesn't necessarily lend itself to understanding the stigmas, the extra barriers that in this case, a man of color would face. Does that not only translate, I guess, to encountering someone on the street at night, but also in cases of who you employ and who you support in that case, Heidi?
Absolutely. And here in Dane County and in Wisconsin, we have one of the worst racial disparities rates in our criminal justice system in the country. And so addressing poverty and barriers to accessing jobs and housing and other things necessary to be self-sufficient, we must look at how the disparities impact, those other things necessary to get your life back together, to be reintegrated into society. And one thing I think is really important is not just making sure less people go to jail and more people are on electronic monitoring or in diversion programs, but being able to support them when they get out so they're not relegated to this permanent underclass. And so I think especially here in Dane County, that work is extremely important. And I think the type of the work that the Poverty Commission should do should be closely in concert with implementation of the Racial Disparities Task Force report and some of the work of the Criminal Justice Council now.
David, if you could hold your thoughts on that for just a second. Again, I think we do have our callers back, and we want to make sure to bring them into the conversation. Caller, your comment or question for our guest, please.
Oh, okay. Is this me?
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay. Okay, thanks. I was thinking, first off, I wanted to refer, if anyone saw the Bill Moyers show the week before last, and he was speaking with two women specifically about Milwaukee. And I was really shocked. I was born there, and I really didn't have any idea. I knew it was bad, but I didn't know that it was, the disparity was so bad and tragic. And I guess I want to, I guess when people, say, well, people really don't want to check, they'd rather work, and that's true. But when I hear that, I think, well, let's get down to the reality of it. I mean, these aren't just people that need work, and everyone knows this, but this is, family's food. And it's not, I don't know. I just, it's so sad, and it's so big, but I just think the realities of it are just, I don't know, I just think sometimes they get missed.
Collie, do you think part of it is we need to be able to put ourselves in someone else's shoes to understand those realities?
No, I think to kind of forget some of our, I think as you said earlier, I don't think we can. I think we have to address just the basic need.
Okay.
And that's what I have to say. Yeah, thanks.
All right. Thanks for your call. We've got a couple of other callers. We'll make sure we get on. And again, we'll try to hold some of the questions and points that folks have raised and after we've had a chance to take those calls. And caller, your comment or question for our guest, please.
Yes, I recently moved to Dane County, and I've lived most of my life on the West Coast. And I was shocked when I moved here to learn that for most people in food service, their base pay is usually below $3 because they speculate that part of the minimum wage will be accomplished through tips. And to me, it seemed crazy because those jobs seem very relative to me in terms of the types of tips that you're getting, and it's speculative. And because one of the main points that both of your guests were discussing was minimum wage and base pay, I was just wondering if they could speak to that and answer the question why that in Dane County, and I believe most of Wisconsin, that's the case for most people in food service, which is a, you know, is a big part of the job market. And I'll take my question or answers off the air. Thank you.
David Reamer, this, you know, brings to mind again the book that I mentioned, Barbara Ehrenreich, writing in Five and Dimed about what it was like to be a waitress. That is tough work. And yet, as this caller is pointing out, very often, sometimes even if you have a bad night and no tips, you don't even rise to the level of minimum wage. Is that something that we can get at?
Well, I think it is. I don't know much about the details of the balance between wages versus tips in the food industry in Wisconsin, much less compared to other states. But I think that the basic principle ought to be that if you work, the minimum wage you get should be a decent one. We haven't raised the minimum wage in this country for a couple of years. Historically, it's fallen behind what it used to be. It should be higher. Let's be honest, if we do raise the minimum wage $1 or $1.50 an hour, there will be some job loss. On the other hand, the benefits of it, particularly in combination with some of the other policies I've talked about, I think far outweigh the job loss. And furthermore, by increasing the return of what you get from when you work, the return to labor, as I think economists call it, you'll induce unemployed people, including people on welfare, to move into the labor market. Even if we raise the minimum wage, however, more, even if it were raised from $7.25 to, you know, $8 an hour or $8.50 or even $9, it's still not enough to get people out of poverty, to get people enough money to pay the rent, pay the electricity, meet their other expenses in many, many cases. So we do have to look at raising the minimum wage in combination with the earned income tax credit, which is a fancy word for basically supplementing earnings. We've recognized that in this country for decades. We've seen simultaneous ratcheting up of both the minimum wage and the EITC going back to the mid-70s. So, again, we need to ratchet them both up. For the EITC, there's a particular problem that needs to be solved, and that is that the EITC doesn't do very much good for people who don't have children living with them. So for a single adult without children, or for an adult who does have children but not living with them, they may be paying child support, they may be unofficially providing help to their own children or children in some family that they're part of, but they can't get the EITC. So a number of experts, both sides of the political spectrum, have said we need to provide a basic supplement for all low-income workers, whether they have children or not, and then make a further adjustment for those that that do have children. The phrase was coined by a fellow named David Elwood. He's the dean of the Kennedy School many years ago, and it was used by Bill Clinton when he campaigned. We need to make work pay. We need to make it so that if you work, if you're playing by the rules, working hard, paying your taxes, that your net income from your employer, whether you're working in a restaurant or some other lower income, lower wage employer, plus these supplements get you a total earnings-based income that's well above the poverty line. Work should pay more than welfare. Work should pay more than poverty. If you're doing everything you can to get out of poverty, you should be out of poverty.
David, I apologize. We're down to our last 6 or 7 minutes, and we do actually have a flurry of callers. I want to make sure you all get on. Caller, your comment, your question, please.
Hello, is it me?
It's you. Please go ahead.
Oh, good. First of all, Barbara Ehrenreich's book is called Nickeled and Dimed.
Oh, thank you.
Just so people know if they're going to look for it, because
it's
a great book. And another book that I just recently read is Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. So I really appreciate the comment about helping people when they transition out of prison back into society. Minimum wage needs to go up, or people should be lifted out of poverty somehow. But the other major problem is the feeder to that system is the war on drugs. That mandatory sentencing that goes along with it, disproportionate emphasis on communities of color. They don't raid fraternities and college dorms where they would find at least as many drugs as they do in ghettos. So I think interrupting that feeder system to the prison is very important as well.
All right.
And thanks. I'll take any comments off the air.
Yes, Heidi Weglander, you had a comment?
Well, I just wanted to make a comment on the minimum wage. You know, we really have an affordable housing shortage and crisis here in Dane County, and I just wanted folks to be aware that a Dane County renter making minimum wage would have to work 79 hours a week to afford rent for a one-bedroom unit. One-bedroom unit, 79 hours a week. You're looking at a two-bedroom, say you have a child, it's 93 hours. So, I mean, you can work, you know, 80 hours a week, two full-time minimum wage jobs, and just barely afford a tiny apartment.
Housing vacancy rates, 1.5% now, and mention the new housing that's being built is not affordable housing.
Right.
So some major problems there. David, you successfully worked through, I think, three of the 4 points as we've gone by. But one thing I just want to touch on are two populations that are particularly hard hit by poverty, and those are senior citizens and people with disabilities. Could you comment on how the Urban Institute plan applies to those folks?
Well, essentially what we did was we just said, look, if you're 65 and older, getting Social Security, or if you have a disability, and the income you get from those sources, plus food stamps, plus your other income, leaves you short of the poverty line, we sort of modeled offering people a tax credit that they could get to bring them up to the poverty line. It's a fairly simple device. Ultimately, we probably need to modify Social Security and SSI themselves, but that was beyond our pay grade, so we came up with this kind of it's a bit more than a patch, but it's not perhaps the permanent solution. The basic principle is what's important, which is we owe our parents and our grandparents who've worked for decades and have now retired on Social Security at least an income above the poverty line. And I think that as a humane society, we owe people who have a disability, who cannot work, an income that at least keeps them in-house, in-home, doesn't put them on the street, lets them afford housing, as Heidi said, in Dane County or any other county they happen to live in.
All right.
I just want to say one quick thing.
Please.
Heidi is just doing such wonderful work, has shown such great leadership, and I just want to commend her and her colleagues on the Dane County Board for what they're doing.
And just to remind folks again, Heidi is part of a new group, Dane County Poverty Commission, that will be starting its work very shortly here. Caller, your comment or question, please.
One of the other big issues we're all facing in this country is climate change, and we're facing it because we burn too much fossil fuel for electricity in big homes, and we travel too much by air, and we drive too much. And the people that don't do this should be rewarded. And that is basically the poor who do not do those things. They live frugally. They don't fly airplanes all over the world, and they drive less. A lot of them don't even have a car. And of course, the elderly that don't have a car and such. And I have proposed that the people who live like this be rewarded on an annual basis. There should be legislation for this to do it. And this would help lift them out of poverty and also help solve the crisis we're facing on global warming.
Caller, I need to cut you off just because we're running out of time and we need our guest's reaction. You know, I think the guest is bringing up something bigger. We live in, so much of our way of thinking is about getting bigger and consuming in a better way. Do folks who have had to adapt to limited resources, do they have something to teach the rest of us, perhaps, David?
Well, I guess what I take from the caller's comment is that when you're dealing with something as big as poverty and its reduction, it does touch on other areas. It's going to touch on healthcare. It's going to touch on education. It's going to touch on segregation in our housing. And it's going to touch on environmental issues like global warming. We need to be aware of that. We need to think about some of those connections.
All right. Heidi, some last thoughts?
Well, I just think that not only do they have less of an environmental footprint, but their low-income people, particularly homeless people, are more vulnerable to extreme weather and the, you know, the consequences of the global climate change. So I think not only, you know, that's a big thing to factor in as well. And I think just a little plug for one innovative approach here in Madison. They're actually working on tiny homes, the opposite of what the caller talked about with the McMansions or whatever, tiny homes, so people have something, some legal safe place to be that's not very expensive.
And it's one of many subjects we hope to explore on future shows. Again, as the work of the Dane County Poverty Commission continues, this, of course, will be an active issue moving forward. David, is there an easy way that folks who'd like to be in touch with you can reach you, perhaps through the Community Advocates website?
That's right. People can contact me through Community Advocates website in Milwaukee. If people want to email me, it's driememr@yahoo.com.